The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the May 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News titled, Enrollment Declines Haunt School Districts That Stayed Remote Longer Enforced Masking. Districts with longer mask mandates also saw steeper declines. By Lauren Camera, posted on April 27, 2022. Public school enrollment dropped more sharply in school districts that remained remote longer compared to those that reopened for in-person learning sooner, a new analysis finds, as well as in districts that adopted heavy masking policies and those in counties that supported President Joe Biden over former President Donald Trump. While enrollment in the country's K-12 public schools has declined nationally, dropping roughly 3% during the 2020-2021 school year, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, it's rebounding in districts that reopened for in-person learning faster and continuing to decline in those that did not, according to researchers at the American Enterprise Institute, which collected and analyzed enrollment data published to more than 12,000 school district websites. I thought we'd see a relationship with in-person learning, but I didn't think it would be this strong, says Nat Malkus, Deputy Director of Education Policy Studies at AEI and Founding Director of the organization's Return to Learn Tracker. It shows just how influential these disparate decisions have been, he says. Enrollment changes. That's a huge fundamental family decision. Each one of these numbers represents a family changing plans. This isn't a small one-off decision, like should we refinance our house. This is along the lines of should we change the institutional home of our child. I found it striking. Districts that stayed remote the longest experienced a two-year enrollment decline of roughly 4.4%, losing around one out of every 22 students, while districts that reopened sooner rebounded, losing around one out of every 93 students. 19 states experienced enrollment declines greater than 3%. Enrollment decreased in New York, Oregon, and Mississippi by more than 5%, with New York schools experiencing the biggest drop, 5.9%. Notably, schools in Florida, where after an initial closure in 2020, like much of the country, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis staked his political career on keeping schools open for in-person learning and passed legislation banning district officials from pivoting to virtual learning due to COVID-19 or imposing mask requirements, posted a 2.2% enrollment decrease during the 2020-2021 school year, just shy of the national enrollment decline of 2.5%. However, the Sunshine State is one of 24 states where enrollment is rebounding during the 2021-2022 school year, clawing back enough students to where its current enrollment decline stands at just 0.9% compared to the 2019-2020 school year. Arizona, Delaware, Florida, Idaho, Oklahoma, and South Carolina made the most significant improvements in recouping students despite not getting back to where enrollment was during the 2019-2020 school year. Just four states, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Utah, posted enrollment gains this current school year compared to the 2019-2020 school year, and Alabama's enrollment remained unchanged. Researchers also analyzed enrollment data based on school districts with high mask usage versus districts with low mask usage and found a similar pattern. During the 2020-2021 school year, both types of districts experienced enrollment declines. Districts with high mask usage shed about 2.9% of students, and districts with low mask usage shed about 2.4% of students. But during the 2021-2022 school year, enrollment in districts with low mask usage rebounded to a 1.9% enrollment decline, while enrollment at districts with high mask usage continued to decline to 3.4%. The pattern also holds when assessing enrollment data for districts and counties that supported former President Donald Trump over President Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election. You see the same patterns, Malkus says. It's not quite as clear, but you see pretty similar slopes in the first year, divergent slopes in the second year. What this tells me is that all of these things get tied together. They're all products of what I call COVID cultural response. The new enrollment data comes on the heels of the publication this week of an academic paper by researchers at Brown University, MIT, and the University of Nebraska, which found that students enrolled in schools that stayed remote longer experienced significantly greater learning loss on standardized tests than those enrolled in schools that were virtual for less amount of time. Offering in-person learning full-time 5 days a week, rather than fully virtual learning, reduced pass rate losses by 13 percentage points in math and 8 percentage points in English language arts between 2019 and 2021, the researchers found. And offering a hybrid model rather than a fully virtual approach reduced losses by 7 percentage points in math and 5 to 6 percentage points in English language arts. With the 2022 midterm election looming, Republicans are hoping to weave these types of data points into a national narrative about pandemic schooling to energize voters, especially after last year's gubernatorial race in Virginia showed the power of focusing on parental rights in public schools. I don't think Republicans are going to shy away from hitting that point hard, says Malkus. In reality, the impact of pandemic schooling is much more nuanced. To be sure, in-person learning was more common in more politically conservative areas, as well as those that tended to be higher income and those that enrolled mostly white students, though outliers to that profile certainly exist. The districts that were remote the longest tended to be some of the biggest and lowest income in the country, enrolled large numbers of Black and Hispanic students, whose families shouldered the economic and health burdens of the pandemic more than other racial and ethnic groups, and faced long periods of high rates of community transmission. And we'll cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Yearbooks on Hold Over Photos of Students Protesting Law Limiting LGBTQ Classroom Instruction. Pictures documenting a walkout in response to Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law should have been caught earlier in the review process, Lyman High School's principal said, posted May 10, 2022 by the Associated Press. Longwood, Florida. Yearbooks at a Central Florida high school won't be distributed until images of students holding rainbow flags and a Love is Love sign while protesting the state's so-called Don't Say Gay law can be covered up. District officials say they don't want anyone thinking that the school supported the students' walkout. Lyman High School Principal Michael Hunter said in a statement on Monday that pictures and descriptions documenting a student walkout in March in response to Florida's parental rights and education law should have been caught earlier in the review process. The bill, signed into law by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, bans classroom instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity in grades K through 3. Rather than reprinting the yearbook at substantial cost and delay, we have elected to cover that material that is out of compliance with board policy so that yearbooks can be distributed as soon as possible, the principal's statement said. In an email on Tuesday, school district spokesman Michael Lawrence said the issue wasn't with the protest, but how its depiction in the yearbook could be interpreted as being endorsed by the school, which would be in violation of the school board's policy. Lawrence noted that the yearbook dedicates a separate page to the school's Gay-Straight Alliance Club and elsewhere shows students at a pride march and holding rainbow flags, and he said these depictions do comply with the policy. The issue at hand here is not the photos or the topic for which the students were protesting, said Lawrence, communications officer for Seminole County Public Schools. If these items were caught earlier prior to print, some simple editing and tweaking likely could have occurred to make that section in compliance prior to print. School officials determined that the least costly solution would be to cover up that section so that the yearbooks could still be distributed to seniors before graduation and the rest of the student body prior to summer break, he said. The yearbook's faculty advisor Daniel Pomerantz told the Orlando Sentinel that she was asked to check into putting stickers over the photos and captions depicting the walkout. She said it would cost $45,000 to reprint the 600 yearbooks. This really shouldn't be happening, because all we did as journalists was document what was happening at our school on our campus, Sky Tiedemann, one of the yearbook's editors-in-chief, told the Sentinel. To have that covered up isn't right. This is censorship. Tiedemann told WKMG that students were supposed to have a party on Monday to have yearbooks signed by their classmates, but that was canceled. Students at the school in Longwood, which is near Orlando, have created a hashtag #StopTheStickers, which is circulating on social media. They also planned a peaceful protest at Tuesday night's meeting of the Seminole County School Board, WKMG reported. Representative Carlos G. Smith, a Democrat who is the state's first LGBTQ Latino legislator, said in a tweet that the censorship is a direct result of the law these students were protesting, hashtag We Will Not Be Erased, in this so-called free state. DeSantis frequently refers to the free state of Florida in his news conferences. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's titled, White House Eyes Digital Divide with Discount for Low-Income Families, published May 10, 2022, by Anna Merid. Dive Brief. In a new bid to close the digital divide, families whose children get free or reduced-price school meals will be among those qualifying for high-speed internet subsidies under a program announced Monday by the Biden administration. The White House estimates almost 40% of American households will be eligible for subsidies, lowering internet costs to no more than $30 a month under the administration's $14.2 billion Affordable Connectivity Program. This is possible through secured commitments from 20 internet service providers promising to lower prices or raise internet speeds for eligible households, according to the announcement. Federal agencies will begin to reach out to households that qualify for ACP based on their income or participation in federal programs, including free or reduced price school meals, Pell Grants, Medicaid, Special Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, and others. Dive Insight. Challenges persist to connect eligible families to broadband programs like ACP, said Doug Casey, board chair of the State Educational Technology Directors Association. It will take creativity at the local level to build relationships and partnerships with families to spread the word and get those who are eligible to sign up. From there, Casey said, localities can share their feedback to the federal level because there's not a one-size-fits-all national approach. So far, 11.5 million of the estimated 48 million eligible households are benefiting from ACP, which is funded by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act enacted in November, the White House announcement said. The latest internet provider commitments mean eligible ACP families will often be able to receive high-speed broadband at no cost, President Joe Biden said in a news conference Monday announcing these improvements. This means fast internet, good download speeds, with no data caps and no extra fees for millions of American families, Biden said. The White House's move to secure more access to the ACP program comes as Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest school system in the U.S., announced its own $50 million effort to provide high-speed internet to its families to address the school system's digital divide. While Casey remains optimistic about Biden's efforts to connect more families to broadband, he said he has seen similar efforts struggle in Connecticut. Casey is also the executive director of the Connecticut Commission for Educational Technology, which the State General Assembly established to integrate technology into schools, libraries, colleges, and universities. For instance, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont launched a $43.5 million initiative in summer 2020 to close the digital divide for students by providing 50,000 laptops, connecting 60,000 students to at-home internet access for a year, and creating 200 public hotspots. Even with this investment, Casey said, not as many Connecticut families took up the offer as expected. When you give people free broadband and you're communicating to them and you think you've reached them, you still haven't, he said. You need to tell them again and again and again from multiple points of view that this service is available and, more importantly, that it's valuable. People can be hesitant to sign up because in a world full of scams, it may not be initially obvious programs like ACP aren't trying to fool eligible families, Casey said. There can also be language barriers, he said, or families living in the U.S. without legal permission who don't feel comfortable sharing their information to prove eligibility. Or some people just don't see the value or don't want internet in their homes, Casey added. While it's exciting access to the program has expanded, Casey said, it's equally promising that federal agencies will reach out to eligible ACP families they already work with under other programs. Education Superhighway, a nonprofit focused on closing the digital divide, has developed a free online toolkit for school districts to help eligible families enroll in ACP. According to a fall report by the group, 18.1 million people live in communities with broadband infrastructure but cannot afford to connect. The key role districts can play is to drive awareness about ACP, Jack Lynch, Chief Operating Officer of Education Superhighway, told K-12 Dive earlier this year. School districts, they're a trusted messenger to their families, he said. School districts can play a big role in helping to get the word out. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, Tuxedos, Gowns, and COVID-Sniffing Dogs, A Pandemic Prom, by Catherine Gewertz. Posted on May 9, 2022. Alexia Ocampo had been counting the days until the prom, but first she'd face the finely tuned noses of a pair of COVID-sniffing dogs. In the 2 days before the May 6 dance, Ocampo and other students with tickets to the Mills High School's prom would need to test negative for COVID-19. In the San Mateo Union High School District, a half hour's drive south of San Francisco, that meant taking rapid antigen tests and being sniffed by specially trained Labrador retrievers, as long as parents gave permission. Students lined up in small groups, while yellow labs named Scarlet and Rizzo walked behind them, sniffing for the subtle odors bodies produce when they have COVID-19. The dogs are trained to sit if they detect the scent. Minutes later, Ocampo, a senior at Mills, was cleared to attend prom. Testing right before a big event that everyone's been planning for is stressful, she said. I'm a big dog lover, so the dogs are a bit of a stress reliever. It takes your mind off it. Mark Benz, another senior at Mills High, said he was happy to get dog sniffed and nose swabbed if it means he can safely attend the prom. It's his last chance. He graduates later this month. It feels great, he said. I feel grateful we're able to spend that time together. Since the dog's accuracy is still being studied, their alerts weren't enough on their own to bar a Mills High student from the prom. School officials based those decisions on the results of rapid antigen tests. But so far, the dog's track record is good. They're almost as accurate as the quick swab tests, said Dr. Carol Glazer, who's overseeing the pilot with medical detection dogs in her role as supervisor of the California Department of Public Health School Antigen Testing Program. For Mills High students, dog sniffing is just the latest in a barrage of changes the pandemic has brought to school life. Like millions of their peers nationally, they've had to learn from home, wear masks when they returned, and endure the cancellation of beloved high school events, from basketball games to formal dances. How to manage COVID risk at end-of-year events. Now that proms are back at most schools, and COVID case numbers are slowly rising again, district leaders are grappling with how to minimize the risk of virus spread at those dances and other large-scale year-end events. The San Mateo District's experience illustrates the challenges and choices many schools could face this spring. It started with an outbreak. Nearly 100 of the 600 students who attended the district's first prom this year, on April 9th, came down with COVID-19. That one was test and mask optional. But the district pivoted immediately, requiring negative tests and indoor masks for proms at its 6 other high schools. They also added another layer of detection, Scarlet and Rizzo. The 2 yellow labs are the stars of the pilot program run by the California Department of Public Health. With a $218,000 grant from the CDC Foundation, the department teamed up with the Association of Public Health Laboratories and Early Alert Canines, a Concord, California-based company that trained the 2 dogs as COVID detectives. The pups now sniff for the virus in 17 elementary, middle, and high schools in the Bay Area. Dogs have a long and familiar history as police partners finding drugs, guns, or criminals. They locate and rescue people in trouble and support people with disabilities. They're also medical partners who can sense low blood sugar or ominous shifts in blood pressure. During the pandemic, experts started training dogs to detect COVID-19, and dogs have been deployed at airports and concert venues to screen hundreds of people quickly. But COVID-sniffing dogs are still rare in K-12 schools. Some schools in Massachusetts have used them to pick up traces of the virus on surfaces so they can be cleaned. A pilot program in Hawaii is using dogs to detect the virus in staff and students. Kenneth Furton, a forensic chemistry expert who leads the study center at Florida International University that pioneered the training of COVID canines, said that a 2021 study of their first 4 pups showed that on average, they detected the virus accurately 97.5% of the time. Handlers who have used the dogs to screen airline employees at the Miami airport have also found that the dogs can pick up the virus before it shows up on a PCR test, Furton said. Early Alert Canines trains dogs to alert insulin-dependent diabetics to drops in their blood sugar. Last fall, they drew on that expertise to train Scarlet and Rizzo. Dirty socks and lunch meat. Training a COVID dog. The trainers use a scent wheel, a big device with outward-reaching spokes, each with a canister at the end. Some canisters contain socks worn by COVID patients, some are empty, and some contain dog treats, such as lunch meat or peanut butter, said Victoria Briskin, the company's development director. Once the dogs learned to alert the right scent, they were deployed to schools in early 2022, she said. San Mateo Union already offers voluntary weekly rapid antigen testing for students and staff, and requires it, in response to California law, for unvaccinated staff members. Adding Scarlet and Rizzo to the rotation provides the district with information that backstops rapid test results and eases the anxiety that can accompany testing during a spike in new cases, said Sarah Devaney, the district's health services manager. It's really turned down the temperature for the kids because they're nervous, Devaney said. The emotional support they bring to the environment you just can't describe. Hillsdale High School was the first school in the district to try the COVID dogs before its prom on April 23. Jeff Gilbert, the principal, said he was a little nervous about how people would react, but he saw right away that the dogs brought more than scientific value to the screenings. People were interacting with them like pets, he said. They were drawing students over to them. The dogs returned the week after the Hillsdale High prom and, together with rapid testing, found 11 positive cases among attendees, Devaney said. Not all were necessarily infectious during the prom, but to be safe, the district contact traced, including notifying all 540 students who'd attended, she said. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The final article comes from Harvard. The final article comes from New York Times, and it's titled, Harvard details its ties to slavery and its plans for redress. The university is committing $100 million for an endowed Legacy of Slavery Fund. Its report carefully avoided treading on direct financial reparations for descendants of enslaved people, by Anna Mona Hartikalis, posted April 26, 2022. In one column are the names of more than 70 enslaved people at Harvard: Venus, Juba, Cesar, Sicily. They are only first names, or sometimes no name at all, quote, the Moor, or, quote, a little boy, of people and stories that have been all but forgotten. In another column are the names of the ministers and presidents and donors of Harvard who enslaved them in the 17th and 18th centuries. Increase Mather, Governor John Winthrop, William Brattle. These full names are so powerful and revered, they still adorn buildings today. The contrasting lists are arguably the most poignant part of a 134-page report on Harvard University's 4 centuries of ties to slavery and its legacy. And they are just an appendix. The report by a committee of Harvard faculty members, released on Tuesday, is Harvard's effort to begin redressing the wrongs of the past, as some other universities have been doing for decades. As part of the process, the university's governing corporation has pledged $100 million in part to create an endowed, quote, Legacy of Slavery Fund that would allow scholars and students to bring Harvard's connections to slavery into the light for generations to come. Experts said the amount of money Harvard was committing for such a project was rare, if not unprecedented, for an educational institution. It rivals the $100 million pledged by leaders of the Jesuit Conference of Priests for racial reconciliation and to benefit descendants of enslaved people at Georgetown University. The report calls for spending the money in a multitude of tracks: by tracing the modern-day descendants of enslaved people at Harvard, by building memorials and curriculum to honor and expose the past, by creating exchange programs between students and faculty members at Harvard and those at historically black colleges and universities, and by collaborating with tribal colleges, and by forging partnerships to improve schools in the American South and the West Indies, where plantation owners and Boston Brahmins made their intertwined fortunes on the backs of the enslaved. The recommendations are somewhat vague, purposely so, Harvard officials said, so that more care can be put into fulfilling them. Some descendants of the enslaved said talks had already begun to figure out how they could work together. But the report carefully avoided treading on direct financial reparations for the descendants of enslaved people. Reparations means different things to different people, so fixating on that term, I think, can be counterproductive, Tomiko Brown Nagin, the committee chair, a professor of both law and history, and dean of the Harvard Radcliffe Institute, said in an interview. She said one goal of the new endowed fund was to drive social mobility by closing gaps in educational opportunity. The university is committed to deeply meaningful and sustained remedies that will endure in perpetuity, she said. Those remedies are focused on leveraging our expertise in education, which is consistent with our mission. Some descendants of the enslaved at Harvard, like Jordan Lloyd, found the university's promises bittersweet. Miss Lloyd grew up in Boston, wondering how her black family had got there. While working as an actress, she paid her bills by waitressing at Harvard's Repertory Theater, never suspecting that she was walking the same streets as an ancestor she did not know about, and will have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.